Let us turn to God's word in 1 Samuel chapter 22. 1 Samuel 22. We read from verse 1 of 1 Samuel 22. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam, and when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. Then there were with him about 400 men. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you, till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. And the prophet Gad said unto David, Abide not in the hold, depart, and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed, and came into the forest of Hareth. David was King Saul's favourite, and a man who had such a wonderfully promising beginning. Chapter 18 and verse 5, it seems to sum it up, when at that point we read, David went out whithersoever Saul sent him, and behaved himself wisely, and Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Saul made him general of his army. He was the darling of his fellow soldiers, the darling of the nation, even of the king. And it would seem as if all was going to be wonderfully happy for David ever after. But life is seldom like that. And a turn of events changed everything forever. In chapter 18 and verse 7, we read that a certain thing happened. When David was returning from a recent battle with the Philistines and had won a great victory, David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, and the women came out of all cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him, and he said, They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day forward. And of course we know how things went. Saul accused David of conspiring against him with Jonathan, his own son, for the kingship. And that was not true. But it is the awful effect when jealousy gets a hold of a man's heart. Saul felt threatened by David and was resentful and hateful of him. He became paranoid, imagining things were not real, things that were not real. He found himself opposing David and fighting against his loyal servant. And as Song of Solomon 8 and verse 6 puts it, jealousy is cruel as the grave. And David, in Saul's eyes, is now guilty of high treason. And David has to flee for his life because a price is on his head and on the heads of any who support David. And so in chapter 22 here, we find David with loyal followers having to run for their lives and hide in the cave Adullam. And the number of his followers are at that point 400. And this includes his parents. It would not be safe for them. If Saul can't get David, he'd get his parents and have no compunction about that. He would have killed his own son Jonathan in his jealous anger. And he would certainly kill David's father and mother. And so, verse 3 of 1 Samuel 22, David comes to the king of Moab and says, "Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you," and gives them a safe haven. Now, you may wonder why Moab and the king were not the Moabites enemies of Israel? Well, they were enemies of Saul, but not of David at this time, because of a particular reason. Ruth, the Moabitess, was David's great-grandmother and the grandmother of his father Jesse. So there was a family link which made for friendship. And so to the king of Moab, David commits his parents for safe keeping in that country. And he explains his current situation to the king. Verse 3 at the end, "Till I know what God will do for me. Take care of my parents. Till I know what God will do for me." And that's his way of interpreting this roller coaster of events that he's been through. And now, really, at his lowest and darkest and most dangerous time, it's all, it seems, gone badly wrong. Terrible reverse, bitter disappointment. "Till I know what God will do for me." We can use language like that when we're in a situation similar to David. Then we are like that man after God's own heart. And the first thing you have here in these words of David is a God-centered mystery. Till I know what God will do, I don't know what he's doing at this time. All this is strange and unexpected in its outcome. It's very far from the time when Samuel came and anointed me king in the midst of my brethren, and I was earmarked to follow Saul and replace him as Israel's king. And it all was so good at the beginning. Saul loved me, promoted me, even gave me his daughter for a wife. And then it all turned sour and bitter and hostile. And now it's all as bad as it can possibly be. And just like I rose to the heights, now I fall into the depths. Till I know what God will do. Even now, it could have been so different. True, God had rejected Saul from being king because of his rebellion and disobedience, and David was going to be king instead, but only when Saul died. So Saul would have lived out his days as king, and then David would have succeeded him, and not Jonathan, the crown prince. But, dear friends, how wonderful if Saul had repented of the way he felt toward David and the way he had treated him thus far, and had acknowledged that David was more worthy than he, and had supported David and helped him prepare for the succession. Now that's what Eli the priest did with Samuel, wasn't it? Eli was informed that his priestly dynasty was to be cut off and finished while Eli was still living, and here was young Samuel growing up to be a prophet and a priest in his place. But Eli didn't turn on Samuel jealously and hatefully and try to eliminate him. He said, "It is the Lord, let him do what seemeth him good." But he trained up Samuel and lovingly guided him and wanted to know what the prophet said to Samuel for Eli, and right to the very end. And there was a gracious heart in Eli, whereby he bowed to the judgment and yet still acknowledged the right of God regarding himself and Samuel, and behaved very nobly. But Saul, you see, so different. He wouldn't have any of it. Nothing would do but that David must die, and he must fight David and kill him and eliminate all pretenders to the throne as he saw it. And that's the difference between a gracious man and a graceless man. Eli had grace to submit to something heavy, and yet had the glory of God in view above his own position. Saul couldn't do that because God had given him another heart, but not a new heart. And so he was without grace. And he doesn't acknowledge God. He doesn't acknowledge God's judgment and Saul's deserving of it. He doesn't acknowledge David and so on. And so he behaves like this. And it would have been so helpful, humanly speaking, if David could have had that situation, like Samuel had that situation with Eli. At least Saul is preparing the way so that it will be a smooth transition. But no, he must be a fugitive, he must run for his life, and his followers and provide asylum for his own parents. And oh, it's as bad as it could possibly be. And there are mysteries, dear friends, in the course of our lives. And sometimes we might think, why couldn't it have been easier than this? Could it not have been that it could have happened a different way, and I could have not been such an object of someone's jealousy or hatred? Could it not have been that there could have been friendliness and warmth and fellowship in all of this, instead of this hostility and opposition? But you see, there is this mystery of God's providence, isn't there? These reverses, disappointments, things not being as we perhaps could wish them to be, and we must be prepared for them. And it's a wise Christian who acknowledges that even among professing believers, there can be those who will turn against you, and those who will be your enemy who once were your friends, and that there'll be difficulties and persecutions and troubles and some sufferings. The mysteries in God's providential dealings. Till I know what God will do. I don't know what he is doing, what he will do, where all this really is going. And it's comforting to know that we have David as a friend in this situation, and that this has not been the first time nor the last time where we're in such a case. But the great comfort is, dear friends, there are never any mysteries with God. He knows exactly what he is doing, the whys, the wherefores, the course of events, where it's heading, where it will end and culminate, and everything. Job, in chapter 23 and verse 10 of his book, he could say this: "He knoweth," or "He performeth the thing that is appointed for me." And many such things are with him. And so God knows. There was that other verse: "He knoweth the way that I take. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. God knows. It's only we who have to say, till I know what God will do. But God knows what he will do. And that's a wonderful comfort. There is still this mystery, but it's a God-centered mystery, because mysteries are with him and belong to him. They're only a problem for us and are only perplexing and hard to get our heads round for us. But then that's all part of his dealings with us for our good. And it certainly was for David, wasn't it? If we are to know God and be a man after his own heart, then we must walk this way sometimes as well, in order that we might learn the lessons and know the Lord like David did. A God-centered mystery. But then secondly, there is a God-centered certainty. Till I know what God will do for me. And that's an impressive view of things. Because you see, David has his eyes firmly upon the Lord. What God will do for me. Not what Saul will do, but what God will do. Saul seems in control of things. He seems to be having his way. But no, God is in control of things, and he is having his way. God is the first cause. Saul is only a second cause. As Christopher Ness once put it, God is the cause of causes. Everything starts with him. Always look above and always look beyond. And that's where our comfort lies. There was another cave that David and his men were hiding in, the cave of En-Gedi, later on in 1 Samuel. And in Psalm 57 and verse 2, David prays in that cave and says, I will cry unto God most high, unto God that performeth all things for me. And so most high, you see, higher than Saul, higher than circumstances, higher than all second causes, God the first cause. Most high, he performs all things for me. And that's a God-centered certainty in the midst of all of this, what God will do. And dear friends, if we have that certainty and confidence, it greatly helps us through, doesn't it? Because we're looking beyond creatures and events and happenings and circumstances and things that are so palpable to the senses. And we're seeing by faith an infinitely greater factor, God, and what he is doing, what he will do for you, for me. That's a great comfort. We walk by faith and not by sight. And if you think about it, God had already done something for David, even at this stage. In the very fact that God is David's hope now. He had not been before this. You will know the early chapters record the fact that when David realized finally that Saul was his bitter enemy and potential murderer, he asked Jonathan for help. And although that was a precious thing to have a close friend at court, it seems as if he was relying on Jonathan very much at that early stage to guide him and help him out. And then there was Ahimelech, wasn't there? The priest, the city of Nob, the priests. And how David ran to there and asked him for some bread and the sword of Goliath and so on. And when Ahimelech wanted to know why David had come unarmed and all by himself, he told a lie and said, the king has sent me on secret business and the king's business requireth haste, and so unworthy. And then, of course, He went over to the Philistines, to Achish, king of Gath. And when he realized he was out of the frying pan into the fire, the only way of escape there was to pretend he was mad. And we know the story. And it's all David, as it were, falling back upon the flesh and his own resort and his own ingenuity and solutions immediately thought about, rather than godly integrity and trusting in the Lord. But now, you see, till I know what God will do for me. And the very fact that he says this is God doing something for him already. Weaning him away from relying upon fleshly means and encouraging him to lean upon the arm of God and prove the Lord that the Lord will undertake for him. And it could be indeed that for us too, when we are brought to this point where we echo the words of David, it must be the Lord, till I know what God will do in the situation, how he will lead me and come in for me. We've already been blessed. We're already being godly. We've already been changed. We're already better than we were, thank God. And so we are learning the lessons, having this God-centered certainty. And there is a sweet hope, isn't there, in these words? What God will do for me. Not with me, as if we're just at God's disposal and he'll do something with us. No, no. David is persuaded that God has his best interests in view. What God will do for me. For me. And you must always have that persuasion that God has your best interests in view. Always your highest interests. And God will bring you into the good of it by one means and another. That's where it's leading to. Believe the best of God. Have the highest and most worthy thoughts of God. Because he's not against us but for us. What God will do for me. These things might seem to be working against me. No, but God is not working against me. God is working for me. That can be a real deliverance, can't it? Because we think all these things are against me, like Jacob, one thing after another, but God isn't against you. The truth of the matter is, people and circumstances can be all going against you, and yet God is the one who is more for you than anything and anyone else. And he's working through these very things and showing you his goodwill and his favor by these very things. Because it won't always be like this. These things will turn and you'll see how that, like Jacob, all these things were not against him but for him, working together for his good. And there is that sweet hope. What God will do for me. And this certainty was strengthened by tokens for good, which David may well have understood. And God does give tokens for good to encourage faith and certainty in him. Little indications that are so sweet. For instance, most archaeologists believe that this cave of Adullam is only a mile or two south of the valley of Elah. And you remember what happened in the valley of Elah? It was where David slew Goliath and where he obtained that great victory in the name of the Lord. And that foul monster came crashing down forwards or backwards, I don't know which. But David cut off his head and, well, that was tremendous. And there he was, just a lad with just one stone in a sling and coming in the name of the Lord of hosts. And God was with him and for him and gave him that great victory. This cave is only a little way away from that. A reminder that what the Lord had been to him then, he can be to him now. That hasn't changed. God is still the God of the armies of Israel. He's still his God and a God for him and to him. And so that's a nice reminder of blessings in the past, and that we hope for the same in the future or in the present. The Lord will not fail me now. And then the other token for good is this, that there were all these people who joined David in this cave of Adullam in verse 2. These people, debtors, discontented people, and others, they were people who had wearied of the reign of Saul and whose lives had been made bitter and intolerable by Saul's unjust reign. And they deserted him, and they came onto David's side, and David became a captain over them. It's important that, you see, that verse 2 says he became a captain over them. They weren't just a mob of malcontents and troublemakers and disaffected characters, that David had this following of these kinds of people. He became a captain over them, and they were his loyal followers. And that 400 grew to 600. And what did it grow to eventually? All of the tribe of Judah when David was crowned king. And then all of the other tribes of Israel when he was crowned king of all Israel when he was 30 years old. In other words, this is the beginning of David's becoming king as the Lord's anointed. It is not a very promising beginning with a 400 of people like this, but he was their captain, and they were acknowledging him as their virtual king instead of Saul. And it was a little type, really, and picture of how the whole thing will be in not too many years' time. And so it's as if he could almost read how it was going and how it would be, that God would protect him, that God would deal with Saul, and that although the path to the throne was difficult, it was sure. And it was a much safer and more blessed path than the path Saul was treading at this time, even though it seemed as if Saul was having the advantage. Better go with God and you're safe, even though it's difficult, rather than go against God if it seems easy, because the way of transgressors is hard. And we know how Saul ended up. So there were these little sweet tokens for good. And the psalmist says, doesn't he, show me a token for good. You can look for these little providential indications that God is remembering you, and he's given you little encouragements to hope in him, till you know what God will do for you. God is working. And till I know, he didn't know then, but he would know. We're reminded of our Lord's words, aren't we, in John 13 and verse 7. What I do, thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know. Hereafter, or literally, after these things. Not necessarily in the hereafter, although ultimately that will be so, but even after these things, after a little while, you will know. And therefore, given that that was the case, till I know what God will do for me, David could be at rest and carry on with his duties. And he did. And did he not provide for his parents, keeping the fifth commandment, honour thy father and thy mother, a dutiful son to protect his aged parents? He led his men as their captain, and they loved him. He kept clear of Saul, the wise use of means, as well as prayer. He composed his psalms, inspired by the Spirit of God, and contributing to the church's praises that would be used ever after. He fulfilled God's purposes on every hand while he knew that God was doing for him. And if we are sure, and we can be, that God is doing things for us in the midst of perplexity, we can have a quiet heart and we can carry on with our duties and do what is obviously the will of God, and whatever falls to our hand, knowing that all is well and that this matter is not for us to have to work out, but his, for him to work out. We can simply quietly do the will of God and wait for him. And of course David did know eventually, didn't he? You've only got to go as far as chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, and you'll see Saul battling with the Philistines and getting killed, and then into 2 Samuel, and you'll see David being crowned king of the tribe of Judah first, and then all of Israel ultimately. And isn't it true that he would not have been the king he became if it had not been for these trials and afflictions, disappointments, struggles? Because character is never forged by easy, straightforward ways in life. When things are easy, when everything comes easy, character becomes flabby. When we have to believe and we have to walk uprightly, keeping God in view, and when there are the exercises and the humblings and the deep dealings of God and the failures and the restorations and the lessons learned, that's what forms character. And that's what prepares for usefulness in God's service. That is why the greater the blessing Christian people end up being, the greater sometimes the trials, often the trials they have to pass through in order to qualify them for that. After all, if you've not known God in that deep way, if you've not proved God when you've needed him most, how can you share lessons with others and be an instructor and an example and a comforter of others? No, the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God, we comfort others with. It's in order that we might be blessed and be a blessing. And let me close by turning you to that wonderful verse in Psalm 37 and verse 23, because doesn't this sum it all up? Till I know what God will do for me. The God-centered mystery, but the God-centered certainty. But here, David, composing this psalm, he says, Psalm 37, verse 23, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. And weren't the steps of a good man like David thus ordered by the Lord? But who delighted in whose way? It's ambiguous, isn't it? Does the Lord delight in our way as he orders our steps? Or in his ordering our steps, do we delight in his way, in the way he leads us? Well, probably both are true, aren't they, in their way? And both must be true. Because if he, our God, is pleased to order our steps in the mysteries and yet the certainties of his dealings, and he can find pleasure in doing that with us and for us, that gives him pleasure. But we must delight in his way for our part. And it is bound to give us pleasure, isn't it? To see all the way the Lord thy God hath led thee, and to know and to trace all his providences and dealings and interventions and interferences, as James Smith puts it, the interference of God, not meant in a bad way, but in a happy way. God interferes, and we want him to interfere, so that we don't have our own way, but his way, where we can delight in his way. And dear friends, we will, because his way is perfect. And though there is mystery, never any mistake, always certain, always blessed. This mutual delighting in the dealings of God concerning us. And of course, ultimately in the glory, when we are in heaven, oh, how we shall delight in God's way. Well, as the hymn puts it, we'll bless the hand that guided and bless the heart that planned when throned where glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Well, may the Lord enable us to say these things, and may the Holy Spirit give us the good of these words, till I know what God will do for me. Let us sing together. Hymn 87.